My name's Lee Howes. I'm a senior engineer at Advanced Micro Devices, and in this instalment of the Direct Compute Lecture Series, we're talking about the basics of GPU-accelerated physics. So in this talk, we're discussing direct compute as used for cloth simulation based on some work we've been doing with the Bullet Physics SDK. We're not going to go into too much detail in terms of low-level optimizations, but we will discuss some high-level algorithmic changes that are useful to obtain performance. We do assume a certain level of prior knowledge, including the basics of constructing devices, contexts, buffers, and the other features of DirectX. And then we're going to demonstrate some cloth that we've been simulating using Direct Compute. So as a brief introduction to Bullet, Bullet is one of the more popular physics SDKs. It's fully open source using a Zlib license, allowing it to be freely used and distributed. And AMD is collaborating on new cloth and physics fluids implementations, as we're discussing the basics of here. Contributions that we make will be fully open source as part of the Bullet tree, so all of this will be visible in time. So introducing cloth simulation. Cloth simulation is based on a mass spring system. A large collection of masses, or vertices, are connected using springs, and the layout and properties of the springs and mass of the vertices change the behavior of the cloth. Throughout the presentation, because of the interaction with meshes for rendering, we use the terms vertex, mass, and particle fairly interchangeably, and spring and link similarly. Spring constraints act as edges in a graph, and their properties and interactions create cloth-like behavior of the mesh, which can be used for interesting on-screen effects such as clothing and flags. So there are three main types of springs. Structural springs are intended, as the name suggests, to provide the structure of the cloth. These springs are stiff and do not allow much stretching in most cloths, though an elasticated cloth is possible and then the stiffness could be reduced. Shearing springs try to keep the mesh in a reasonable shape. Often these springs are no different in strength from structural springs, and indeed when using a triangular mesh, these can be seen as the same thing. The final type of link is the bend link, which is a set of longer range links to provide a weak 3D structure for the cloth. Without these links, the cloth would tend to fold sharply at vertices. These bend links should be generally less stiff than the structural and shearing links or springs that we described earlier, which make up the core structure of the cloth. As a cloth begins to fold across a vertex, the bend link connecting the particles either side will be shortened, creating a compression from its rest length and applying a force to push the particles apart again. So when simulating cloth, we can see that there's a substantial amount of parallelism. There's a large number of particles, and the force from each spring constraint is applied to both connecting particles with a similarly large number of springs or links. Later processing is also highly parallel. We can solve for collisions between the particles or links and other objects, and also we can add wind effects, and we will see that briefly described in a few slides' time. So we start by knowing the original layout of the cloth, and from this we can compute the rest length of each of the springs. And the rest length is important for computing stresses in the mesh. Each spring behaves according to Hooke's law, that is, that the force applied to and by the spring is proportional to its extension. The stiffness property we discussed earlier acts as a multiplier to that ratio, allowing us to control the way the cloth will behave. From the force applied by the spring, we can compute a new location to move the mass to balance the forces in the mesh. And from these impulses and velocities, we can compute new positions for the vertices in the cloth. In this diagram, we see the position corrections as sums of the forces applied to the springs. The reality is somewhat different, as we have to consider transitive effects from forces that move neighboring vertices. If we compute the entire solution in parallel, then forces will take n time steps to propagate across the cloth, where n is the number of links. Instead, we wish to use an iterative solver that works both quickly and creates a fast propagation of data across the mesh, solving for a stable set of forces across all links. A pure parallel implementation with double buffering, though completely parallelism safe, would propagate too slowly from frame to frame. So one of the simpler additional interactions we can perform is the addition of a wind effect to a scene. To achieve this, we can either apply an acceleration directly to a vertex, or we can apply a force based on an interaction of the wind force in the air and the cloth. For our purposes, the wind as applied to a given cloth has a single velocity, clearly a more complicated wind can be imagined that is properly simulated with vortices, etc. In addition, we know certain information about the cloth. We know that we have a face connecting a given set of vertices. We know the positions of these vertices, and from that we can compute the area of the face and the area contribution to each vertex. And then we know that the velocity that the vertices currently have from the time steps of the cloth being simulated previously. From the combination of the wind velocity and the vertex velocity, we can compute the relative velocity of the wind at the vertex. And the wind applies a force to the vertex based on the area of the cloth that the vertex has control over and the density of the air medium. An impulse is applied to the vertex based on this force and the vertex's mass. So Bullitt already has a CPU-based cloth simulation, and that's what all this GPU work is based on. This solver executes link by link, computing the force applied to the vertices at either end of the link, and moving those vertices before moving on to the next link. In this serial fashion, forces will propagate very quickly through the mesh, immediately if they follow the serial computation direction. And the link order could be changed on alternate solver iterations to balance the propagation across an animation sequence. In addition, the sequence of operations is reproducible, making this approach deterministic. So looking at a brief pseudocode implementation of this, we can see that we will iterate the solver a number of times, usually a fixed number, to maintain predictable performance. We then scan through each link in turn, and then compute the ratio of the total mass attached to the spring and the stiffness coefficient of the spring, which will change depending on the type of link we have in the mesh. We produce a position correction based on the stretch ratio of the link and the original positions of the vertices. Note that the same movement is applied to both vertices on the link because the same force is applied to each by the spring. So we've seen how this worked on the CPU, where we had a serial implementation with no atomicity issues and immediate value propagation from a given update. And the purpose of moving to the GPU is then to exploit the large amount of parallelism and memory bandwidth available on the device. And this parallelism creates problems of its own. In the serial implementation, we have no problems with links updating at the same time, and the value propagation is immediate in at least one direction through the cloth. If the GPU simulation is fully parallel within the cloth, and using the same algorithm as before, updates to the same node create races. So the simplest solution to this problem that maintains the same link-wise computation and determinism of the original CPU code is to create independent subsets of links that we can process. We can take a set of links that each connect to a pair of nodes, neither of which connects to any other link in the batch. Each batch of links can be processed entirely in parallel because there is no read-after-write dependence, as there would be performing a fully parallel update of the mesh. Of course, we continue this process. So here we see the same mesh with two batches created, and three. And finally, we realize that we need no fewer than 10 batches to fully cover this mesh. This means that we have 10 sets of link processing, each of which is internally parallel, but which must be processed in series with synchronization points in between. So when we look at the code to drive this, we will generate a loop, first for each iteration, and then we'll iterate over the set of batches that we've defined. Thanks to the static nature of the cloth mesh, these batches can be pre-computed, so the graph coloring need not be performed on each frame. We'll take the subsets of the total set of links and process those as we processed the links before. The batches were pre-generated as mentioned, which also means that the link buffers can be pre-sorted. So rather than having to use indirect indexing to look up these batches, we can specify link ranges for computation directly, going from the first link in a batch to the final link in the batch as a contiguous set. The core loop of the algorithm varied only from the CPU code in terms of its bounds and the order of links in the buffers it uses, and so it is now entirely parallel. While the loop is parallel and deterministic, it should be noted that when executed in parallel, it changes the behavior of the solver substantially, thanks to a significant change in the order of propagation of position updates through the mesh. Not only have we changed the order, which is true even when the loop is executed serially as a result of the sorting of the link set, we've also changed the number of steps that propagate values. So once we have 10 batches, instead of the 55 we effectively have processing this same mesh link by link, Each batch propagates values to neighbouring links, but this propagation has been reduced by a factor of 5. Though it might now propagate out for middle values, it's no longer able to propagate from one side to the other. To actually dispatch a batch, we first need to set up its constant parameters. For this, we'll have created a const buffer at some point during the initialization, in the same way that we create buffers for other input and output buffer. This const buffer is represented on the host side by a structure, and on the HLSL side by a C buffer, as we will see in a few slides' time. The structure is used as the basis for allocating a device-side constant buffer in much the same way as allocating input and output data buffers. It's important to note that the constant buffer as allocated on the device must be a multiple of 16 bytes in size, as it's mapped to an array of four-length registers. The difference from a normal buffer is that we specify the bind and CPU access flags appropriately to support constant buffer behavior. To use the constant buffer, we will have an object created from the constant buffer structure on the host side, which we can fill with whatever values we require as inputs to the kernel. In this case, we have two constants that are relevant to the kernel, the first link in the batch and the total number of links in the batch. With this information, the kernel will know how much work it's supposed to do and where to obtain its data from. To copy the constant buffer across, we map it to the host side. In this instance, it's necessary for us to perform this copy for each iteration because each batch requires different parameters. In general, we could have copied the constant buffer to the device just once and performed set constant buffers appropriately each time. Which approach is necessary depends on how often the constants change. For ease, we've stored the constant buffer reference within the kernel description, and we map this reference. In this case, we've mapped a given constant buffer. The buffer was created and is living on the device and is now full of data thanks to the map and the memcopy. We assign it to a register offset so that when the compiled shader accesses a particular register expecting a certain constant, the correct buffer will be read. In this case, we've started the constant buffer at a constant register vector register 0. We'll see how this appears in the HLSL code soon. For each buffer that we want to utilize in the shader, we select the appropriate view and map that to the appropriate texture or an ordered access view register within the HLSL kernel. In this case, we've mapped the shader resources separately. Alternatively, we could have created an array and passed the set in one go, because the registers we wish to map inputs to are consecutive. Then we set the UAV for the input and output of the position values for the constraint solver. In the current setup, we're processing a single direct compute thread for each link in the batch. So we'll set the compute shader kernel to be used by the next dispatch to the solve positions kernel and dispatch it with a total work size equal to the number of links, as we set it in the const buffer. So that means we need to dispatch a certain number of blocks, and this number of blocks will be the appropriate number to serve a rounded up number of links, rounded up by the block size. And this will be important later in the HLSL code. And for completeness, we should tidy up the state at the end of the call to ensure that buffers aren't passed to later dispatches, creating additional dependencies and unexpected behavior. Of course, we should perform this tidying up for each resource, only showing one here for space. So looking at the HLSL code itself, in the HLSL file we have the const buffer and the input and output buffers for the kernel. First, we can see the constant buffer that closely matches the structure used to represent the buffer on the host side. The entries in this constant buffer are in the module namespace, available for use directly without naming the constant buffer in which they're contained. This allows for restructuring of how and when constants are updated on the device without changing the kernel code that references them. Then for each of the inputs and outputs, we define either a structured buffer or an RW or read-write structured buffer. The latter allows read-write access to the data and has one of the unordered access views created on the host side mapped to it. Raw buffers are also possible, but for our purposes, the structured buffers provide a cleaner solution for this implementation. Throughout this example, we see register mappings for the buffers, whether to the first vector register to be used by a constant buffer, that's B, a texture, or to an unordered access view. These are not necessary to include in simple cases, but they'll be inferred by the compiler based on the order of declaration. In more complicated cases, their inclusion can improve clarity, as they reference the indexing provided by the first parameter of the CS set shader resources or CS set unordered access view calls. We can see here how the register index maps to the first parameter of the call. The kernel is parameterized by the usual direct compute parameters representing the group ID, the thread ID both globally and within its group, and the group index. In addition, we specify the block size that will be dispatched. This specifies the number of threads that will be executed together and able to synchronize. A number of blocks will be dispatched to the hardware, each having these dimensions. Note how this links to the minimum number of blocks we dispatched at the dispatch call that we saw earlier. In particular, as we dispatched by number of groups, and hence implicitly rounded the number of threads to a multiple of block size, we need to mask out the threads that do not have valid data to process. It's possible that padding the links array would be a more efficient solution to this, but that depends on how big the groups are and how many are going to need to be masked out. So many of the values are constants, and in this case we factored out the linear stiffness coefficient and mass pair into a pre-generated array. This presents an interesting trade-off for programming the device. In many cases, the high ALU throughput of the GPU makes pre-computing constants unnecessary, and indeed, by putting extra strain on the memory system, doing so can be counterproductive. In this case, as we do not otherwise need the stiffness value in the kernel, the load that we could have used to obtain that, and then to use that to perform the constant calculation in the kernel, instead we can just use to load the pre-computed value. And so there's no overhead to doing so. Then looking at the core loop of the kernel, first we need to load the appropriate data for the computation. Note that this does use an indirection from the node index array, and that vertex positions is in a read-write data structure. This sort of indirection can hurt performance, particularly due to a loss of caching in read-write data structures. We then perform the computation itself, and this is not significantly different from the core of the original CPU loop. We see that the same computation is being performed. And finally, we're going to output our results to the positions UAV. This is an in-place update, which is why we needed the patching. So now we're going to see a simple demo of the cloth being simulated on the CPU and then the GPU, seeing how we get a performance improvement. Right, so here we see five cloths being simulated using the CPU implementation that we discussed, and with a wind interaction, moving the cloths around and making them flutter, and we're changing the wind direction on each frame. And note the frame rate that you see on this version of the demo. And here we see the same thing simulated on the GPU using that very basic link-wise batching. And notice that we're achieving a much higher frame rate now, even though we're using a fairly naive GPU batching implementation. So we've seen the demo, and now we're returning to a discussion of batching. One serious problem with the approach discussed is the number of dispatch calls. Thanks to the GPU being remote from the CPU and accessible across the PCI bus, there's a relatively significant overhead present in each kernel issue. If the kernels are fairly short, with a low work density per thread, and the number of threads is small, then the cost of dispatch can easily become the limiting factor in performance. For example, in the demonstrated example, each cloth consisted of around 1,500 vertices and 9,000 links. If we have 10 batches and assume that each batch is the same size, which is not quite true as they tend to tail off in size, we will only have 900 links in a batch. With 128 threads in a block, we only have around 7 blocks issued for each batch, which is not enough to fill a 20-core device such as the AMD 5870 GPU, and certainly not enough to cover the memory latency that might arise. The result is that the GPU becomes heavily underutilized and execution becomes so fast once dispatched that we're dispatch limited. Luckily, the cloth is a relatively static structure. We can pre-process it to produce larger groups to be dispatched by individual threads and fewer batches. The level of grouping seen in this diagram reduces our number of batches slightly to 9, and the work density per thread has also increased by a factor of 6. We can, of course, go further still, creating particularly large groups with substantially higher work density per thread. And in this diagram, we only have 4 batches, so reducing the number of dispatches. The downside is that by packing so many links into a single thread, while we've increased the work density per thread, we've enormously reduced the number of threads that are going to execute in parallel. So we're still going to suffer from very poor utilization of the device and far from peak performance. We do have the benefit that from the point of view of solving internal constraints, as distinct from collision constraints, cloths are entirely independent entities. Therefore, it's possible to batch multiple cloths together without creating any data access hazards. In this case, we're processing three cloths together using that highest level of grouping we just saw, so still with only four batches. We've reduced the overall number of dispatches by 2/3, and even though we're now processing a lot more cloth. And at the same time, we've regained parallelism in each given dispatch by multiplying the number of threads that we need to dispatch by a factor of 3. Another approach to solving this problem takes account of the fact that the iterative solver propagates changes in position from one vertex to another on a given iteration. The serial CPU implementation is capable of propagating position all the way across the cloth during one iteration. By changing the order of execution in making the solver work in parallel, we change the behavior. Now, the previous implementations, while they changed this behavior, did maintain determinism, because the order of the solve, and hence the behavior of the cloth, will be consistent from one run to another. That's not the same as saying that the behavior will be the same as the CPU implementation, of course. And this determinism is important in many cases. For example, if we were running a network game and we wanted the cloths to behave the same at either end of the network connection, we might need to run in this way. However, if we're willing to relax the determinism constraint, we can look at solving per vertex and pulling data, whether it's new or old, for neighboring links. In this case, we've removed the write after write hazard, and we only have a read after write hazard, which is what creates the non-determinism. But we can then rely on the iterative solver to still give good performance even with that read after write dependency. The advantage of this approach is that we can perform just a single iteration of the solver as a single batch. We can also reuse position data for the central vertex. We need to perform twice as much computation because the vertices at either end of the link will each individually process that link. But this shouldn't be a problem on the GPU, which tends to have a surplus of ALU capacity. The lack of propagation of many of the written values, as the scheduling of processing of one vertex after another might miss values, can lead to slower conversions of the solver. But as we have a single batch, we can consider running more iterations to remove that problem. There will then be a trade-off given that more work is being done per pass than in the batched version, so it only makes sense if the number of extra iterations needed is small enough and the gain from fewer dispatches significant enough that the overall simulation performs better. And this is more likely to be true if we have a small amount of cloth. If we have a very large amount of cloth, it might be better to use a simpler batched solution. So another problem with using this is that we have to remember that the GPU is a collection of SIMD engines. On any SIMD engine, a branch that creates a need to mask out elements of the SIMD vector is wasting computational resources. If we're computing per vertex, then the vertices will have a different connectivity. So some vertices will be connected to more links than others. And therefore, to solve that vertex, we would require more iterations of the solver loop inside the kernel than for another vertex. Because the cloth is a static structure, and because we can do all this pre-sorting, this gives us the opportunity to pre-sort the vertices so that we pack into a single SIMD unit a collection of vertices that all have the same degree, so that we remove the problem with these divergent branches and regain high performance. So moving on from algorithmic optimizations, we can see one of the major benefits of direct compute. While not directly part of the DirectX graphics pipeline, direct compute shaders can be used to generate data structures that can be used by most stages in the pipeline itself. This close interaction makes direct compute particularly useful for developing efficient computational operations that interact with rendering in complicated ways. Such kernels can execute and be scheduled by the driver without the need for high overhead locking, unlocking, and pipeline flush operations that might be necessary if you wanted to stall the pipeline, wait, compute on the CPU, and copy back. This useful property is relevant to this example because the common use for this sort of cloth simulations is to generate vertex positions and to then use that mesh for rendering. The mesh will be textured, lit, and displayed by the graphics pipeline in the standard way. A cloth mesh can contain a large number of vertices, each one carrying additional data such as normals, texture coordinates, and for efficiency it doesn't make sense to copy that data back to the host, upload it to a buffer for rendering, where we have to lock all the buffers and synchronize with the graphics pipeline, and the additional latency of multiple copies occupying the PCI Express bus. Instead, we can output from a direct compute kernel directly to a vertex buffer, which can be used immediately by staging the graphics pipeline, and the entire process can be heavily pipelined and scheduled by the driver to permit efficient device utilization. To achieve this, we have to create a vertex buffer in the traditional way, as it would be used for the rendering stage. In this case, we include position, normal, and texture coordinate data in our buffer layout description. We then go on to construct the layout object from the layout description. We then take the layout and construct a vertex buffer from it. Note that in addition to the bind vertex buffer flag, we have bound the buffer for unordered access so that we can assign it to the output from the cloth simulation stage. We then create an unordered access view to take account of this, which will be mapped to the parameter list of the simulation output kernel. The dependencies between the simulation stages and the rendering stages will be handled automatically by the driver, making this simulation a highly efficient addition to the graphics pipeline for our physics application. So now we're going to show a quick demo of the cloth in action in a full scene. So in this Japanese courtyard scene, we see two different types of cloths being simulated. We see these curtains in the background, and in the foreground these banners hanging from poles. Note that the banners are wrapping around the poles, and so there's collision being supported there, and they're also attached to various points all the way up the pole. If we switch to wireframe mode, we can see the simulation in terms of the vertices and links responding to the wind. In particular, we can see that the curtains in the background are very high fidelity meshes and get a very nice and smooth behavior. Although in the banners in the foreground, we do tend to see the links showing up a little more. So we've seen a basic introduction to cloth simulation, along with a discussion of its parallel implementation. We've seen a selection of high-level algorithmic optimizations that offer scope for improving the performance of such a simulation and hint towards the sort of optimizations you will need to perform in your own applications. We've also demonstrated some of the direct compute features necessary for implementing such a simulation, with the aim of getting you used to direct compute as a whole. Thank you for your attention.